Alrighty, happy Wednesday. Welcome back to Aces Up the Sleeve, the video version for our YouTube watchers. And for our listeners, it is just going to be a normal audio podcast. But for our listeners, as always, I am Patty. I'm co-hosting with the co-managing partner of Pocket Aces Racing, Jared Shoemaker, or Par, for the quick reference. And today we're going to be joined by the regional manager for the Jockeys Guild at the Aqueduct, Belmont Park, Charlestown, Delaware Park, Meadowlands, Monmouth Parks, and Saratoga locations, Keith O'Brien. Whew, that is a list.
Thank you.
And lovely Meadowlands. How are you doing today? I know, right? Like, uh-oh, what happened here? Oh, my system got mad at me. No, it didn't. I lied. This is the great start to our first ever video recording. But in this podcast, we are going to shed light on all things Pocket Aces Racing. We are going to talk about the finer points of syndicate ownership. We're going to discuss what our listeners, our viewers, our fans, and our, you know, partners have asked us to talk about. And, you know, we are industry participants, so we're going to talk about the industry at large. But before we get going, before we jump right into our interview with Keith today, Keith, how are you doing? Thank you for joining us. We were just talking about how you're going to be. Yeah, you're going to be the very first one for our video podcast episode. So thank you so much. It is an honor.
That's awesome. I'm thrilled. I'm very honored to be the first video interview.
Well, we certainly appreciate taking time out of your busy schedule, as Patty was given during the introduction there. You got a lot on your plate, but at least a lot of tracks on your plate, and I assume that that translates into just a whole lot of other, you know, just all of the stuff that goes along with it. So much appreciation for your time, and appreciate you bearing with us as we get our feet wet with this new format we're trying here. So,
absolutely, my pleasure.
Very good.
So in this week, we are going to sit down with Keith, and we're going to talk a little bit kind of about like what got him into racing. We ask a lot of our interviewees. We're going to talk a little bit about what the Jockeys Guild organization actually does and the importance of having representation for riders in every state with racing and at just about every track, if not every track that offers it. So we'll just go ahead and jump right into it with our first little introductory background question. You know, what got you into racing?
Well, actually, I was born into racing. My dad was a steeplechase jockey in America in the 60s, early 70s. He then segued into training, and he trained thoroughbreds for many years. He actually trained a pretty famous horse in Saratoga called Four Star Dave.
Okay, yeah.
Ooh, absolutely. All right. The Sultan of Saratoga.
So, yep, exactly. Very nice. So I've kind of, horse racing has always been part of my life, from my wee days. And I kind of, I went to college and I got a bachelor's degree in political science, but the pull of horse racing was just too strong. I kind of followed suit. I followed my dad. I rode over jumps for a little while. I trained for several years and now I'm in a new capacity working for the Jockeys Guild.
So, you know, very nice. There must be a common trend with political science majors going into horse racing.
I was going to say.
Mark Wampler, my partner in Pocket Aces Racing, his degree is in political science. So there must be a good correlation there. So,
yeah.
We can't say it's the less stressful job, that's for sure. I think they're both equally as stressful. Not.
I guess there's a lot of people, and even myself to a degree. You know, I'm vaguely familiar with the Jockeys Guild. I know that you guys represent the jockeys and it's such a dangerous and hectic career that they have. And but just if you could just kind of give our viewers, our listeners, a little bit of an overview on the role of the guild, how things all work within the guild and just what you're doing to help out the riders every day.
Sure. Well, I mean, number one, like the Jockeys Guild is just that. It's an organization that advocates for the jockeys. It's their organization. There's a lot of steps that have to be taken. I mean, you talk about safety, number one. Safety is a priority for the Jockeys Guild, safety for the horses, safety for the jockeys. Well, I make sure when I go to the different tracks one of my first jobs is to make sure that the safety protocols are in place. You know, that is the ambulances, you know, is the ambulance following the racing? Is the proper workman's comp in place? Do they have an on-track accident policy? You know, that's the priority, first of all, is with that. And then, you know, there's the medical standards for each racetrack can be a little bit different, you know, and we're trying to create a uniform medical standard, you know, so that there's paramedics on the grounds. You know, in the case of a catastrophic injury, the protocols are in place where there's no question, there's just action, you know. That's priority number one. Priority number two, you know, there with HISA and with all these new regulations and restrictions and penalties, you know, we have to fight for the jockeys and to educate, really. We have to educate a lot of people, you know, how important, you know, safety is, and also things like the riding crop. You know, the Jockeys Guild has fought tirelessly to maintain the crop, not to abuse a horse, but for corrective measures and safety measures, you know? Yeah. And let's see, I mean, we're also trying to work on the scale of weights for jockeys. I mean, jockeys nowadays, they're getting taller, you know, as everyone is getting bigger, you know, and the weights were set, excuse me, the scale of weights were set about a century ago. So those need to change, you know, and along with that, you know, if you can raise the minimum weight a little bit, so right now it's 118 for 3-year-olds. If we can get that to 120, you know, that means maybe a jockey can have a banana in the morning, you know, right, and not worry about it, you know, and also going along with that, with the weight, you know, it's a mental thing. You know, we're very aware of the mental wellness nowadays and the mental health of these athletes. And that's what jockeys are, you know, they're professional athletes and they train, they're extremely disciplined, and they also, you know, they're not immune to the criticisms on social media, et cetera, et cetera. And when you factor in, you know, if a guy is starving and just punishing his body to try and ride, and then the demands to produce and to win, and then plus the criticism, you know, there's a lot of factors that the jockeys have to deal with, and we're an organization that's there to support them and to help them and to educate them as well.
So now do you also work with, you know, the exercise riders at the tracks, or are you exclusively, you know, just jockeys that are riding in the afternoons, or is it optional for riders? Are they able to opt into the system?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. No, right now the Jockeys Guild just works with the jockeys. And, you know, every jockey has a choice. I mean, they're independent contractors. So they don't have to join the guild, but of course we want them to join the guild because a united voice is a stronger voice. You know, and if you have all the jockeys on the same page, and we can fight for them, but it's strictly up to the jockey as an individual if he wants to join the guild, you know, but it really behooves them, you know, to join the organization, because we're, like I said, we're there to fight for them. We're there to advocate for the jockeys.
Right. Now, do you guys get much involved with, you know, the standard mount rates and stuff like that at each different track, or are you all involved in that negotiation? So kind of just, because I know there's more that goes on than just looking, you know, trying to keep an eye on safety regulations and all that. You know, it's just, you're a union, so you're representing the riders and all aspects of their relationship with track management and the HBPA, I assume, correct?
Oh, absolutely. We work tirelessly to, you know, increase the jockey fees, the losing mount fees, you know, because, again, it's something that hasn't really kept up with inflation, you know. I mean, there's a lot of tracks where their mount fees are, they haven't changed in 10, 15 years, you know. And I mean, when you think about, you know, say, for example, $100 for riding a horse, it's not a lot of money, you know. And then out of that $100, they have to pay their agent, they have to pay their valet, and they have to pay taxes. So at the end of the day, if you ride a race and you finish seventh, you're not coming home with an awful lot of money, you know, for the risk and for the training and the years of dedication that it takes. So it's something that we work with horsemen's organizations, we work with the racetracks to try and improve that, and we're doing that right now. We're trying to raise the minimum the minimum rate to $150 per mount, you know, which is not, I don't believe, unrealistic, you know, considering,
now you're looking,
you know, with inflation and with.
You're looking at that for,
I'm sorry?
You know, is that going to be, you know, basically you're hoping to get that industry standard every track in the country?
Yes, yes, exactly. You know, I think, and I don't think it's unfair. I don't think it's unrealistic, you know. I mean, the jockeys, I mean, and when you think about, too, what jockeys have to do to secure mounts, I mean, they're going out in the morning, you know, they're breezing horses or sometimes even galloping horses. They don't get paid for that. You're doing that when the hope that you're going to ride that horse in the afternoon. So, I mean, if for $150, you know, that's a lot of work you're putting into just for that $150. And then hopefully you can win. I mean, obviously the objective is to win and win as many races as you can. But, you know, being realistic, you know, there's a lot of guys out there that don't ride a lot. You know, they don't win a lot. So the $150, it's significant for them.
Yeah, and I definitely support that. And I think that, you know, I agree with you 100% and agree completely. We're going to have to get some tracks to adjust and increase purses because, you know, the owners are the ones that are paying that, and that's fine. I'm happy to do it. You know, those guys, you know, every time they get on a horse, they're putting their lives at risk. And you know, so for me, sure, let's pay them $150 a mount. Let's pay them $200 a mount. I'm good with that. And, but you know, there are some tracks around the country that we need to catch up, and we know that they've got the money. We know that they can put more money in the purse structures if they were so willing. Many of them just choose not to. So, and again, I'm not asking you. I'm not saying Belterra Park needs to make their maiden specials $30,000 a pop instead of $16. But you know what? Let's get it up there to somewhat reasonable. You know where. Everybody that's involved can continue to make a living at this.
Yeah, exactly. That's the priority. Is, I mean, you know, you, sure, you do it. We get into the game for the love of it, but at the end of the day, you have to be able to make a living. Right. You have to be realistic, you know. And that, and I agree 100%. You know that the purses need to be increased. You know, everything across the board for everyone, for the owners. The owners foot the majority of the expense. I mean, they deserve more as well.
But again, to me, the riders are they're way more responsible for winning any races than I'll ever be. You know, all I do is write checks and talk. So, but yeah, I definitely think that. I mean, again, it's I've known too many riders, or too many riders have ridden for us over the years that have suffered. You know, career-ending injuries, and they have suffered. You know, one that rode for us a lot, and he got killed on the racetrack. And you know, they literally are putting their lives on the line every time that they get in the saddle. And we need to recognize that as an industry, and do better by them, for sure.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the horses are the star, but the jockeys are the face. You know, right. I mean, without the jockey, you know. There isn't a horse race. So it's very important. I mean, and that's actually, I'm glad you pointed that out. I mean, we work closely with the PDJF as well, which is the Permanently Disabled Jockey Fund, for, you know, to provide for jockeys who have been injured in a catastrophic accident, haven't been killed, thankfully, but they can't ride anymore and they need financial help. And we're actually also instigating, we go to a lot, not every track has this right now, but we've established an agreement with Transamerica to have a retirement account for the jockeys.
Oh, nice.
You know, so like each, so they take a whether it be an amount or a percentage of their jockey fee, and it goes straight into an IRA, you know, so that, and that they can forget about it, you know, and then at the end of the day, when they finish riding, that they have a little something, a little nest egg saved, you know.
Sure.
And I think it's very, very important for them. You know, the young jockeys, especially the young riders, you know, they think it's never going to stop. You know, right. They're riding, they're winning, they're making money, you know, and they're spending it as they're making it. But, you know, you try and educate them to, you know, well, put a little aside as well for the rainy day and for when you finish riding.
And for casual fans of racing, you know, I think they maybe, you know, they could listen to a conversation like this and be like, what are those guys talking about? I watch Saratoga and Keeneland and Churchill Downs on the weekends, and those races are crazy money, and the jockeys are making crazy money, and why should they be, you know, they're taken care of. But the vast majority of the jockeys in this country are not riding at Churchill Downs and Saratoga and Keeneland. In fact, it's all the same guys that are riding at Saratoga that are also riding at Keeneland, and then they're moving to Churchill. And you know, most of the folks that are in this game, I think of Perry Utes at Belterra Park. The man is he's hit 70, right? Patty, do you know?
He's in the 70s.
The dude is still out there riding. He's riding every morning, and he's riding every afternoon, and he's still riding well. And
I think the statistic I read about him was like he's one of like two jockeys left in the country that like was riding when Secretariat was racing. I think that's the statistic I read somewhere. Like, it's wild. Like, we joke that, you know, Perry Utes is the evergreen man, but like Perry Utes has been around a while.
Been around he's a long time. And he's still riding at Belterra Park, where the most money he's ever going to ride for in any one race is, you know, when you, if it's a state bred and he's running an open company, you know, he's probably riding for a maximum purse on a very, very rare occasion, $40,000. And it's usually he's riding for $10,000 or $15,000 purses. And, you know, and that's, mm-hmm. and that's the reality for most of the riders out there. There's way more Perry Utes's and Deshaun Parker's than there are Tyler Gaffleones and Junior Alvarados.
Yep, absolutely. And that's who we fight for as much or even more so, is for the small guys. The guys are riding at the small tracks. And you know, and a lot of times they'll wonder like, well, okay, what is the guild gonna do for me? Well, we're gonna fight for you. That's what we're gonna do. You know, we're gonna try and get, you know, like I said, the losing mount fee up. We're gonna try and protect your interests, you know. And you know, if they run afoul of the stewards or there's a miscommunication, you know, the Jockey Guild is there to represent them and to be their voice. Mm-hmm. You know? And but like you said, but it's very important that they understand that every track is extremely important. The guys at Belterra are just as important to us as the guys in Saratoga.
Right.
You know, they're all very important, you know?
Absolutely. So now, do you all provide health insurance and things like that for riders, or is that an option for them?
Really? Well, what we do is we have a temporary disability policy, so that if they get that, pays them for up to 2 years. And what we've partnered with some tracks, not all tracks, a reimbursement policy. So if a jockey, you know, they have for their personal insurance, if they go to the doctor and they provide receipts, they get reimbursed for that money. You know, their premiums can get reimbursed, but not every track is on board. And, you know, that's something we're fighting for as well. You know, we're trying to get, I mean, New York is on board. Churchill Downs is on board. The Stronach Group, they're on board. But several of the other tracks are not. And that's a difficult fight, but it's a fight we're doing and we're performing and we're trying to get, you know, to get coverage for these guys.
Well, I tell you what, every time I get my insurance bill from NYRA, they need to be taking care of the riders better than anybody, because Lord knows they are charging owners out the nose for it. And which is fine. Again, you know, I'm not complaining. I'm just saying I hope that the guys are getting, and the ladies are getting what you know, they're getting what they deserve from NYRA, because man, I think just, you know, we ran second in that race, or third in that race, and earned $11,000, and almost 3,000 of it went into, you know, one was workers' comp, and then another fund, and you know, which is great. Again, it's fine, it's great. But man, I hope using those funds appropriately and doing everything they can. So it's good to hear that they're, you know, they're reimbursing for, you know, health expenses and things like that. So that's good to know. That makes me feel even better about them taking that money out of the purse account for it. So it's good.
Oh yeah, no. Rest assured, it's going to the guys that qualify and that need it. Absolutely. I mean, there is a number of rides. You have to ride at least 200 races in New York to be eligible for it.
Gotcha.
But once you reach that point, you know, they're eligible.
So it's total 200, not on like a yearly basis, right? Like it's a total 200.
No, New York. 200 over the course of a year.
Over the year. Okay.
So yeah. just you touched on the number of races you're riding in New York. So explain a little bit, you know, apprentice jockey and journeyman and, you know, all those different things. And I assume that you deal with those guys on different levels and you know, maybe they have different benefits based on the number of mounts they've had or wins. I don't know. Maybe they do. Maybe they don't. But can you get into a little bit of that for us? I think probably a lot of our people don't know. Hear us talk about a bug or an apprentice, and they don't know what we're talking about.
Oh, sure. Well, an apprentice or a bug rider is someone that gets a weight allowance for, you know, in a ride. You know, they're inexperienced. You know, it's usually their first or second year riding races professionally. So it starts off as a 10-pound. They get 10 pounds off. So if a horse is carrying 122 with a journeyman jockey, which is a regular jockey, under an apprentice, they'd be carrying 112. You know, so that's a significant weight break. After they win five races, that allowance goes to 7 pounds. And then when they win their 35th race as a 7-pound apprentice, they get a year with the 5-pound with a 5-pound allowance. So, I mean, it's the idea is, you know, your lack of experience, you get weight off of a horse. So that's an incentive for an owner and a trainer to ride you. And then, you know, and you'll see the really good apprentices will ride tremendous amount of horses because yep. They're good and they win. and the weight allowance is a big advantage for them.
Absolutely. So now are there different, you know, levels of support or, you know, for the apprentice jockeys versus the journeyman jockeys or the different services that you guys offer different?
No, all jockeys are entitled to the exact same, you know, like I said, we represent apprentices, we represent journeymen, we represent a guy that rides 10 races, we represent a guy that rides 1,000 races. They're all equally important to us, and they all get the same amount of attention.
And so so when they come to the track, you know, they've probably been riding somewhere at a training center or, you know, ride in the mornings for a jock or for a trainer, and they come and say, okay, I'm ready to, you know, I'm ready to ride in the afternoons and be a rider. How does that, what's the process of getting them into the guild and getting them representation and you know, how's that all work for them?
Well, I mean, if a young woman, you know, they want to be a jockey. Okay, great. You know, they have to go and learn the rudiments of riding. You know, a lot of times you go to a farm in Ocala or Kentucky, they'll learn how to ride. Then they'll get hooked up with a big trainer, the big outfits. And, you know, you're galloping horses and you start breezing horses. And then you're breezing. And it takes about a year or so of steadily breezing horses to develop your seat, to develop an understanding of, you know, okay, communicating with the horse, understanding instructions. And then basically, you know, you'll say to a trainer, you know, I really want to ride. Will you give me a shot? Will you give me a chance? So, and then once the jockey's name appears on the overnight, then they can get licensed. Okay. So they can go to the gaming commission and they get licensed as a jockey. And then from there, they can start to ride. You know, sometimes they'll have an agent right away. Sometimes, you know, agents will want to see them ride a little bit, see, okay, are they going to make it? Or, you know, what kind of a work ethic do they have? Are they going to work hard, et cetera, et cetera? You know, and then once they're a jockey, once they're a licensed jockey, they're eligible to join the guild and we welcome them. And we hope they do. A lot of times, sometimes they wait, you know, the apprentices wait until they've won a certain amount of races. I think that might be a little misconception on their part, thinking, oh, no, I'm not good enough to join the guild, but that's not true. I mean, once you've ridden one race, you're a jockey, you're welcome to the guild, and we want you.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah, it's, you know, I'm guilty as anybody that probably is a casual fan and how I'm right in the middle of the industry. And you know, I don't really I've learned more about the guild today than I've ever known. So, you know, I think it's really, I appreciate the information. And, so you've got kind of the Mid-Atlantic area, and how many other regions are there that are represented?
Well, there's the South, you know, like your Florida tracks. Then there's the Midwest, which is broken up into two. You've got sort of Kentucky, Ohio, Louisiana, and then there's Oklahoma, Colorado, And then the West Coast, you've got, of course, you know, the California tracks and some of the Oregon or Washington State there. So there's a regional manager for each of those areas.
Gotcha.
Like I said, like every track, you know, whether it be a fair, but if there's jockeys that are members of the Jockeys Guild, we're there and we represent them.
And exclusively thoroughbreds or no quarter horses or anything like that?
No, quarter horses too.
Okay.
No, yeah, quarter horses as well. I don't cover quarter horses because obviously there's no quarter horse racing here, and I'm not really, I don't have that much experience with quarter horses, but Daryl O'Hare, you know, Javier Torres, these guys, Joel, they handle the quarter horse jockeys as well.
Okay, very cool.
Cool.
Yeah, I love summertime and the summers because, you know, that's when most of the racing activity is happening. And going on to Equibase and pulling up the condition book pages and seeing all of the tracks that you never hear about, you never see, and you know, Nebraska and Idaho and, you know, all the different small little tracks all over the country where, yeah, I think they race, you know, two or three, maybe 4 weeks out of the year. And I'm always fascinated, you know, how do they even get the riders to get in there for those couple weeks to even be able to card all the races that they card and horses and trainers and the whole nine yards. So I know that's not the area that you work in, but do you have kind of any concept of just, is it like they travel around from small little track to small little track to small little track? You know that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's like that's your typical sort of the nomadic lifestyle of a lot of these jocks, you know, like that will go and ride these short-term meets, you know, and if they provide purses and there's horses to ride, you're going
to
get jocks.
Somebody's going to be there to ride them, right?
Yeah, exactly. Somebody wants to and is there willing and able.
Yeah, if you bring it, they will come.
Yep, exactly.
So kind of just switching away a little bit from your role in the Guild and just thinking about the industry as a whole and for you personally, is there a horse or a race that just, when you think about it, just, you know, the nostalgia hits you, you know, it just stands out in your memory. Just something that really, you know, a moment in racing that just has been left an indelible mark on you as a fan of racing.
I mean, yeah, absolutely. I mean, and I'm a little selfish, but I mean, the horse that made my dad, I mean, that made things possible was Four Star Dave. You know, he was everything to the O'Brien family. Yeah. and then when his younger brother won the Irish 2000 Guineas, Four Star All Star, that was a momentous occasion. You know, I mean, it was something that had never been done before. And it's long, I mean, we're talking 30 years before, you know, Wesley starting going to Royal Ascot. You know, I mean, my dad conceived this idea to go to Ireland and win a classic, and he actually pulled it off.
Right.
that was pretty cool. It really was.
That's great.
I remember talking to my dad about that. When Four Star All Star was a 2-year-old, he said, you know, I think I want to take this horse over for the 2000 Guineas. And I thought, what? Are you crazy, Dad? Why do you want to do that? He said, no, I really believe this horse could do it. And I thought, I mean, I'm a son, and here am I thinking, crazy, Dad? Sure enough, though, he did it.
That's great. So the whole family go make that trip?
Actually, my mom and my dad did. I wasn't able to because I was riding over jumps at the time.
Gotcha.
So I was at a place called Radnor, Pennsylvania.
Oh, yeah.
Riding in a jump race on that day.
I tell you.
You got to work.
The loudspeaker. Yeah, exactly.
I have a very
love-hate
relationship with jump races. I love it. I'm fascinated by it. It is... I think it's beautiful to watch. You know, I love going to, you know, and I was slightly different, but like the cross country events,
I
was doing at the Kentucky Horse Park. So I love them. I think it's very exciting racing to me. But, and Patty's probably heard me tell this story before, and I know some of our partners, about some people that listen to this probably know
the losing wager.
So there were four of us that went to Keeneland on a Thursday, on a Friday afternoon. And we started at the very first race on Friday. We each put in $2 and we started to show parlay. We cashed out at like, you know, several hundred, many hundreds of dollars each on day one, and mm-hmm. then left some of it to start over on Saturday. And we did not miss a single race. And it comes to me, my turn, and it's the Queen Elizabeth race where they used to do the jumps at Keeneland. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I know nothing about betting them. I've watched them. I think it's cool. It's a lot of fun. And you know, I'm looking at the weight. These riders are like 150 pounds. And I'm like, this is unusual.
Yeah.
Right. And I know I turn, and it's like up to $500-$700 again in the pool. And I'm like, I don't have any idea what to do. So I'm just going to bet on this favorite. And I can't remember the name. And he hadn't lost a race in like, he won like 7 or 8 straight races. I'm like, I'm putting all the money on them. At first I begged him, please don't make me bet this race. Nope. Got to do it. So I did it. Put it all on the favorite. Very first fence, he dropped the rider.
Oh.
So I've had
that's like the best feeling.
Better about that for 15 years.
that's heartbreaking. I mean, I wish I could say it doesn't happen very often, but it does happen.
Yeah. I mean, no, that's one of the
pitfalls of jump racing.
That's right. But I am fascinated by it. It's a beautiful. Most of them are so graceful going over those fences, and it's just I love watching it. So
yep.
I'll never bet on them again, but I love watching them.
it's usually the form of a jump race works out a little bit better than the form of a flat race.
Yeah,
but there are those occasions if somebody makes a mistake over a fence and deposits the jock.
Yeah, he was like, you know, 1-5 or something like that. You know, he's the surest thing that you're ever going to see. And I'm like, I know we're supposed to bet long shots, but I'm putting it on this one because it's too much money and I don't know what I'm looking at. And sure enough, down he went. But anyway.
Oh gosh. You know, it's actually, there's a funny story. There's years ago, there was an old gambler here in New York. And he always used to ask us, you know, what do you think your horse? And one day he started talking to me about a story. He said, I remember when your dad rode over jumps. I said, oh, yeah, that's right. He said, you know, I never used to bet the jumpers, but one day your dad was riding a first-time starter for Sydney Waters, a horse called Baylar. And this horse was a nice horse on the flat. You know, he'd won a lot of races on the flat. He might even have been placed in a stake race. And he said, I'm going to bet this horce. I'm going to bet this jumper. He was like 3-5 to win the race. It was at Saratoga. And he's in front every step of the way. And the last fence, he made a mistake and my dad fell off him. And the guy said, I never bet another jumper after that.
Never again.
Very similar to your story.
I'm glad I'm not the only one that has sworn off because of that.
Yeah, so you're not alone.
Well, if you could just imagine for a moment, you know, there's been a lot of changes in thoroughbred racing over the last couple years, especially. It's changed dramatically, I think, in the last 20 years that I've been involved. But if you're king for a day in the sport and you can make any change, what change would you want to make to improve our industry?
I grew up in racing. So, and I grew up when the big outfits, you know, I remember vividly, you know, when Green Tree had a barn and Firestone had a barn and Darby Dan had a barn, you know, and obviously the Phipps is Rokeby. And I really believe that the size of public stables is too big. It's too industrious almost, you know, I'm not trying to denigrate because obviously the trainers that do that are excellent at their job. They know how to train horses, but there's an awful lot of trainers out there that are good horse people that are hard workers. They never get a shot,
yeah.
You know, and with the decline of the foal crop, you know, to where it is now, we're lucky if we've got 20,000 foals. that means that there's even less of a pool to draw from. So if you still, if you have these, you know, say 10 outfits that are, have several hundred horses, you know, obviously they're going to have 100 two-year-olds. They're going to have, you know, 50 maidens. And then you've got a an outfit maybe with five or six horses. He's got one two-year-old or two two-year-olds. He's got a maiden. You know, the disparity of competition, I think, is just, it's bad for the sport and it's bad for gambling too. I mean, I think from a gambler's perspective, you're not getting any value. You know, you're, you've got these five or six horse maidens, and obviously there's one or two of them that are overwhelmingly better than the rest of them. The rest of them are in there to fill races. And you kind of wonder, well, how long can that really go on? You know, I mean, how long are the people with, you know, a handful of horses going to support racing so that the same guys can go out and win time and time again? You know, it's a, it becomes a vicious cycle. You know, so that, I mean, that is my perspective. I mean, I know it sort of goes against the American way, you know, like freedom of making a living and free and trying to build something big. But, you know, American racing was built around racetracks, and those guys that, that developed racing understood with parimutuel wagering, you know, the importance of big fields, you know, so they never, I mean, you know, the Whitneys, the Vanderbilts, I mean, they could have had 500 horses if they wanted, but they understood that they had to keep it to a certain number in order to promote competition, you know, to promote, you know, and sport. And that's what I think has been lost, you know. I mean, how do you get it back? you're going to have to ruffle a few feathers, but I think ultimately that's something that should be looked at very seriously.
Yeah, I mean, it's,
that's my opinion.
I can't find fault with that. I mean, I think you can look to California and you can see the tail end of the results of that. I mean, I think a big reason that California racing struggles is because of exactly what you said, and that's part of it, anyway.
Yeah,
so,
yeah, it's certainly part. Yeah.
All right. Well, again, thank you so much for joining us today. I sincerely appreciate it. I know you're super busy. And I think, you know, one of my favorite parts since we started doing this podcast, one of my favorite things is getting to learn more about the pieces of the industry and the roles in the industry and the people involved in the industry that are behind the scenes and we don't really get to see otherwise. And we don't really have maybe a full grasp of what's going on with so many of the most, you know, the jockeys are, again, as you mentioned earlier, you know, they're one of the most important pieces of this. There's the horse, there's rider and there's owners, and those three pieces kind of make it all go. But there's so many more pieces with the grooms and track superintendents and, you know, just everything, you know, there's so many pieces involved in this industry that most people aren't aware of and never get to hear from. So I really, really sincerely appreciate you joining us today.
Oh, thank you very much. I mean, and to add to that, with all those pieces, it's so important that they communicate, you know, like the Jockeys Guild communicates with the track superintendents, you know, with the trainers, with the executives, you know, it's having open lines of communication behooves us all. And benefits racing in general, you know, to create the product that people will want to come and see and wager on.
Yeah, absolutely. I cannot agree more.
Well, and it's like, you know, I don't know any situation really where, you know, four people stood in four different rooms and talked to themselves and anything got done, you know, like it's kind of what it feels like sometimes that everybody's screaming in an empty room, but they're not screaming at each other.
That's right. I know. Yeah. I mean, you need the discourse. You need to be able to respectfully disagree and say, no, we need this, or, you know, like, okay, if you give us this, we'll give you that. I mean, whatever it may be, you know, there has to be communication.
Yeah. Well, appreciate all of your efforts, to represent, the riders because, well, like I said, numerous times today, I mean, I have so much respect for them and I'm a little amazed every time that they go out and just put it all out there on the line, like they do. And, so appreciate the fact that they got somebody like you in their corner helping them out.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Patty, close us out.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thanks everybody for tuning in to our listeners and to the watchers this time when this inevitably goes up on the YouTube. So thanks to everybody who tunes in every single week. We appreciate everybody's support no matter what mode you use to listen to us talk to ourselves. Make sure that you are subscribed to any of our channels, which is the Apple Podcast and the Spotify. Make sure that you are also on our social media pages, which is the Facebook, the Instagram, Twitter. I think we're also on Threads now. I know I've been getting notifications about the Threads, so we're also over on Threads if anybody has migrated over there. Make sure that you are also subscribed to the YouTube channel. We're Pocket Aces Racing under all of these social medias, under the YouTube. It's all Pocket Aces Racing. And make sure on that YouTube you hit the bell so you do get the notification when this video inevitably goes up and when others like it start going up as well, especially for our September sale and our October racing. I know the Cut the Deck miniseries is going to be going to Keeneland for that first opening weekend in October. And then we're going to have a lot of Keeneland September features and interviews and stuff for you guys to enjoy. So definitely tune in for those as well. And as I tell everybody every week, have a happy Wednesday, have a good Wednesday, make good choices. And the podcast is out.